Welcome to the Human Experience Podcast with Carl Sokia.
Aloha! And welcome to yet another episode of the HX Podcast featuring Carl Sokia. Now, today is another wonderfully special episode with a man that I absolutely just adore and love. In fact, we go way back to childhood, and what's really funny about the two of us is that you actually couldn't tell us apart when in our younger years. And what's funny is my own grandmother, we used to sing and dance and perform together and entertain, and my grandma would often look at my mother and say, "Which one's Carl?" Luckily, all of that has changed over the last 25 years, and he's the handsome one now, and it's kind of like the Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger twins episode where I'm kind of the Danny DeVito, and this guy's definitely the Arnold Schwarzenegger. No. But without further ado, I want to invite or welcome one of my close friends, a brother, Isaac Colasima, to the show. Isaac, thanks for being here, brother. Sure, dude, appreciate it.
No, I love being here, and you know, everyone should know we're a second generation friendship too.
This is truth. Our fathers were friends and played rugby together in Tonga, and we didn't find that out until we became friends. And then
we were friends. And they run into each other at a dance thing. And my dad, you know, who is always like, "Oh, my son's a dancer." And then he sees you and he's like, "Wait, Sokia."
There's only one family with that name.
Exactly.
That's right.
And you kind of had that crazy boy thing going. And he's like, "He's got to be Sokia."
That's right.
And my dad loved your dad. It's like, you know, because every team needs that guy that's good, but also like loosens everybody. And that's what
exactly
he says your dad
right.
was. You know, your dad was the guy.
Yeah, there you go. So, that's right. So I would say, you know, I'm the junior version of my dad, and I walk like him and talk. Everybody's like, "Oh, I can tell you your dad." I grew my beard out, and people thought I was him. I mean, it was kind of fun, but you know, take a lot of pride being that second generation.
Oh man, I wish I could grow a beard like you.
No, he's got the best beard. My dad's got a great beard. I grow an okay. Jen likes the beard though. So
you got a good beard. Like this thing. That's all I can grow. Like, and I've been growing it since I was 21, just so I could look at least 21.
Oh, I love it.
I don't know how you used to sneak us into clubs as kids, because I mean, like, you guys looked older, but when I was 16, I looked 8. So I don't know, I don't know how you pulled
it. I don't know how we did it either. We got, I think it was a 14 or 15-year-old Zach White in a club once, and that kid looked like he was 12. So that was,
I was the younger years. I just always told everybody, you know, if Carl wants to go, we can go. That's what it was always like.
Oh boy. So hey, I'm glad to have Isaac here, because Isaac has had such a wild life.
Yeah.
A lot of fun things, a lot of adventures, a lot of experience, and, you know, beautiful family. His two daughters are here in the studio with us talking family and drawing and, you know, doing their thing. And it's just, he's raised such a beautiful family, but also gone through a lot in his life. You know what I mean? And I've always, you know, kind of looked at Isaac. We've gone through a lot of parallels in our life, which I think kind of bands us together, you know, being, you know, half, you know, Afukasi, which is half race, you know, half white, half Polynesian. And I think he felt a lot like I did, especially in our younger years. Yeah. I was trying to identify who I was. I didn't know if I really fit in with the Polynesians. I don't really fit in with the Hispanic cats. Like, you know, I remember in elementary school, I had a big medallion I'd wear that I thought I was African. Like, I didn't know, you know, I think we were just trying to find our identity. And you'd go to the East Coast, and still sometimes this happens where, what is a Polynesian? Like, are you half like Mexican, half, you know, Asian,
I'm Puerto Rican every time I go to New
York. That's right. Yeah. You know, they don't know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think you and I were able to bond in that nature as well, just trying to figure out who we were, our identity culturally, and so on. So that's something that, you know, it's nice to have these beautiful daughters and children and family and be able to really, you know who we are now and be in our own skin and kind of, move forward.
It's wild when you look at it too. You know, cause like being raised in Pleasant Grove, like, my parents weren't together. So my dad moved out here. He started the Provo Steelers, the rugby team. So my dad was like this legend to the Tongans.
Yeah.
But like, I was being raised by my mom, and we're from the Monson side. We settled Pleasant Grove. I was raised in the house that my great, great, great grandpa built after he came from Nauvoo. And it was like, what's interesting too is like finding your place. What I always thought was interesting is growing up in Pleasant Grove, I was the brown kid. There was me, and then there was this black kid that lasted a couple of weeks. And then he wore all red, and that was it.
You know, sure, right?
Got attacked. But, you know, it was back in the gang days. But it was interesting because we all forgot I was brown.
Yeah.
There. And it was to the point where, like, we go to basketball games, we'd be like, "Oh, you guys got a Polynesian." We'd all be looking around like, "Oh, yeah. Oh, me. I'm the guy."
Yeah.
Sorry. You know, and it didn't help that I was doing the other stuff. But I think, I don't know, maybe it raised me with that right perspective for what I'm doing nowadays.
Yeah.
Because I've never, skin color was like hair color to me growing up. You know, and I feel like it was for all of us, you know, especially as dancers. Because what I loved about being a dancer in our dance groups was, you know, you're judged. I mean, they obviously want to make a group that looks diverse, but once you're rehearsing, it's just how good are you?
That's right.
You know, can you work together? Can you do it? And don't, you know, I love this story with your grandma because I thought it was hilarious. But for the record, I did feel like you were working so hard to keep up, you know, and you were like, awesome. And it was like, and it was like,
I was working hard to keep up. That's about
well,
it.
I mean, you were like 30 times the athlete I ever was.
Oh, you're so funny.
And so it's like, you know, and besides, I was obsessed with dancing. Like, we would end rehearsal and then I'd make sure everyone was gone. And I'd practice for the next 6 hours because I needed to be as good as Lenny. And that was it. You know?
Shout out to Lo Lenny Nuusila.
Lo Lenny, man.
Our brother.
That was mad. The three Pollies.
Yeah, that's right. The three Pollies.
Yeah, but it was like I needed to be that good, right. You know. And I just
obsessed.
I mean, you introduced me to a part of the arts I needed to learn, though. That's the thing, like, you know, and this is being honest and true. Like my mom, you know, arts are serious for her. She's a very serious artist, and growing up in the arts the way we did, I live in the arts right now. I make a living off the arts, and what you did to me, I'll never forget. And you could ask my old assistant guy that I work with every once in a while now, Jay. Yeah. I made him listen to Purple Rain nonstop from Vegas back home to Orem the whole way through. And he was like, man, what the heck? I was like, yeah, Carlos Lequia introduced me to this
album. I'll tell you what, I just barely did a Facebook thing where somebody challenged me on one of these, you know, crazy challenges saying top 10 albums. I was like, how do you even do that?
Yeah.
Purple Rain was the first one I posted.
Purple Rain, man. Dude, I'll never forget. Like, I'm sitting there at the soundboard, we're waiting for rehearsals, and then you put in a CD and run to the stage.
Yeah.
And then that organ hits.
Dude.
And you're like, dearly beloved. And I was looking at him like, oh my gosh, my life just changed. What is going on? I have that album. I've been listening to it like crazy. I'm a diehard Prince fan.
Yeah.
I argue with everybody that wants to argue Super Bowl performances because I think Prince was
What about entertainment? Well, it started raining too, and he got Purple Rain.
Rain, Purple Rain.
That's from the heavens.
You can't, it's never rained at any other Super Bowl.
I know, right?
I'm just saying, like.
Right when he's singing Purple Rain, come on, the heavens are involved.
That's just.
But I mean, going back to that, those are entertainers, right? And I get that from my parents. My parents bought them video. I remember my mom loved Prince. In fact, when he came to Salt Lake for the first time, I took her to the concert. But it's, you know, they bought that video, and you know, even though it was rated R, and there's a scene that, you know, they would never let me watch, and you know, I'd get out of the room. Just the entertainment factor and the music and so on. That's my parents would always play records. They buy. We were, you know, bought a CD player when first CD players were first, you know, kind of introduced. We were early adopters in music and entertainment. And you know, my dad dancing at PCC. My mom loved music, loved dancing. So that's the world I was raised in. Yeah. So that's how you kind of defined yourself. So those kind of things, they're from the heart. Like it reminds me of my parents. Like I think of Prince and Purple Rain. I think of my parents. You know, I think of growing up. I think of my childhood. Like, and that's the beauty that you tie to it, right?
See, when I picture that soundboard alone on the stage with you and me, and Lenny was there, Corey was there, and I think about it all the time, to be honest, because I was such a serious artist at the time. And like you guys broke me into being a little more like, okay, look, you can enjoy what you do.
Totally.
Because I had left the dance club to join you guys. And the dance club appealed to, I feel like I got the perfect mix of my mom's obsession with the arts and my dad's competitive fire.
Yeah.
And so when I joined the dance club, the studio in Orem, you know, they're like, okay, you can do this, but it's 40 hours a week. You miss a class. You got to do double time to make it up. And I was like, cool. Do I get a national title? I'm in.
Yeah.
You know, that was that.
Competitive.
And so then I show up with you guys and I'm like, hi, I'm here to win. Let's do it. And you guys are like, well, we just want to have fun.
That's right.
You know, we're just playing. And by the end of it, like, I mean, all of us were family for life.
That's right. That's right. Because we'd entertain together, but we'd play together. And it's just, it was a big family. You're exactly right. In fact, that's where I met my wife. Best friend, my closest friends, Jan is still, now Jan teaches vocals to our oldest daughter. I mean, that was my life.
She has a son named Isaac.
That's exactly right, right?
You know, what the crap?
Shout out to Jan. Love Jan.
Freaking love Jan.
Yeah, right. So.
But I saw her a little while ago and was like crying.
Yeah.
I hit it.
Incredible human being.
Because I wanted to be tough, but you know.
Yeah. Talking about Jan is a whole other podcast for a whole other day. Yeah, I could go on for days with that lady, but. So I guess, you know, kind of looking at, you know, growing up, so, you know, growing up in Pleasant Grove, trying to figure out who you were, you adopted kind of this love for the arts. Mm-hmm. Walk us through how kind of, you know, you got into dance and then you kind of worked through the whole dance world and got to, you know, the love of, I mean, I remember going through, you know, a PGJHS. I'll never forget that because, you know, you do the lighting and everything for the stages and you really fell in love with that aspect of the
sound,
world. And then all the way to where you are today and how that all morphed together. Walk us through that.
You know, wow, you know, it's kind of funny when I think about it. Everything I do that is of value in my life, I learned from my mom.
Sure.
And that's just straight up how it was.
Yeah.
Like everything, my mom, And it's, I think it's a Holosema boy thing, yeah. but it's Polly's, but I think it's like kicked up a million notches with, yeah. with my dad's family. Cause my dad has only put up one picture of like all of his family.
Yeah.
And it's my grandma's passport photo. He blew up so it could fit inside of a frame.
Sure.
And it's just, for some reason, that's what it is. And so my mom was the world to me. She was alone. She was raising me in a trailer park in Provo. It's gone now. There's a mall there. And it was just her. She was 20 with a little brown baby.
Sure.
You know, she's a blonde hair, blue eyed Swedish girl, yeah. like ready to go to college. And, yeah. and I, for some reason as a kid, my mom always talks about it. I just wanted to make life easy on my mom.
Sure.
That's what it always was. And yep. so I would watch TV.
Yeah.
And what I would do is I'd get up in the morning and I'd turn on like the Polka Dot Door and Mr. Rogers. And I'd turn the speaker low enough that I have to put my ear on it.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it wouldn't wake her up in the morning. And yeah. then I would watch TV during the day. And it's when I saw the movie Scrooged and they show him watching TV all the time, yeah. it kind of reminds me of it. But the difference is it isn't sad for me.
Sure.
Because our situation was rough. You know, my yeah. mom made our presents and all that. But I liked it because it gave me this world that I could attach to my world. And I think that's where I was different than a lot of kids because I wasn't escaping. I was adding to my world.
Right.
And it changed the way I saw the world around me, where when I would have a friend, now they're part of my world. And right. I get to see what makes it work, what, yep. how's it goes. And so I became obsessed with that. So my mom noticed when I was 5, I memorized Michael Jackson's Billie Jean dance, yep. watching it on TV.
Yeah.
You know, and I only got a couple times to watch it. And she was like, I think he's a dancer.
Yeah.
And so she put me in dance, which I know my dad, because, you know, I was a decent athlete, but yeah. just there's one thing when you go to practice and you leave, and it's another thing when you go to practice and you just can't. You want to be better.
That's right.
You know, and that's what I was with dance. And
yeah.
And so I clung to it. And then I discovered everything after that. And it got the way I ended up in television. Because to dance, I think what I liked about dance was when you hear a song that matches an emotion,
yeah.
you feel. Like when we're sad, we look for that song.
That's
you know,
right.
When we're
That's
happy,
right.
we look for that song.
We relate to it. We catalog it. We live by it.
You just need it. And, yeah. and the thing is like, I didn't want to just hear the song. I wanted to be part of the song. And
right.
so like, whenever I hear music, I'm part of it. And that's what started happening with me. But because I was this little brown boy that was obsessed with dancing, my mom, she threw me to some studios and I couldn't stop. I couldn't quit. I didn't like being in the back. So I would always make yeah. sure like I was front.
Yeah, you know? Right.
And if I wasn't front, I would look at the people going, I'm going to take your spot.
Yeah.
I'm going to be there with you. You
yeah.
know, I didn't want to beat anybody because I didn't want to make anybody feel bad.
Sure. But you want to be on that level.
But I wanted to be with them. And that's kind of the motto of my life with everything I do. But you know, you fast forward in the future and I go to a big, you know, huge dance competition with a group that wasn't, you know, they weren't really competition worthy.
Yeah.
And I got noticed by another studio, but I also get noticed by commercial people.
Yeah.
And they asked me to do a commercial. And that's where I meet Ryan Osorio, one of our other good friends
yeah,
we danced
brother.
With. And then I find out, because my mom, she got married again when I was 3.
Yeah.
And then he came out as gay when I was 14.
Yeah.
And thing is he and I were really, 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 we're still really close. I still call him dad.
Of course.
You know, it makes me my story even more unique when I think about it.
Absolutely.
But it meant nothing to me at the time. It was just like, yeah, it's dad, whatever. You know,
exactly right. You love him regardless. He's your family, man.
No, he's my dad.
Yeah,
know?
That's
you know?
Family.
And so it's interesting because he came out and acting came to me at the time when my mom didn't have a job.
Yeah.
And she was working at a newspaper, but newspapers don't pay a
right.
lot, you know, and
advertising.
Yeah. And so, yo, I at 13, I was just kind of helping pay the bills all of a sudden.
That's right.
And it was weird because I didn't really want to act. What had happened was I loved movies. I discovered Star Wars and yeah. Return of the Jedi when I was 8, I memorized. And when I say I memorized it every single sound effect, every single cut, every single line, every single thing that possible. And we recorded off TV. I memorized all the commercials that I had fast forward through, how fast they could go. And right. then I watched it so many times the audio went out and it was okay because I could recite the entire movie. And to this day, I think that's affected my clock in film.
Sure.
To the point where I have a very studio trained clock for editing, which yeah. is kind of hard to explain, but it's just, I have an editing clock that's very studio
yeah.
and it worked out for me. But then when I really wanted to get behind the scenes because the first movie that really made me want to direct now that I was in the film world, I was like there's this world open up to me and maybe I can hang on to this, even though I didn't like acting, and but I liked helping my mom.
Yeah.
And then I saw Glory.
Yeah.
And Glory, when I was in fifth grade, I bawled. I fell apart.
Sure.
I couldn't get enough of it. And yeah. And I realized I wanted to make things that make people feel like they can let go.
Sure.
And that movie just inspired me.
Almost take what you get out of dancing.
Yeah.
And you want to be able to transform other people.
Exactly.
You're doing that same thing to them. Exactly. I love it. That's, you know, beautiful.
That's a good way of looking at it, because dancing for me is personal.
And, that's
and
right.
I don't think a lot of people, you know, when I go to clubs with my friends and all that, they're like, yeah, here we go. They're looking around at me. I am in my own world that's on that right. floor, you know, and I'm dancing. Yeah. People are battling me. I'm like, whatever, yeah. I'll battle you.
I'm babe. In my world right now.
Yeah, it's like, cool, I'm going to do fuetes and then I'm going to do something weird, you know, it's going to blow your mind. But, this was my chance to share what I feel inside.
I love it.
And it's weird because maybe it is, you know, we were talking about Callahan earlier and stuff, you know, maybe I did, because, you know, when you're asked to be the man when you're young, you know, you kind of have to put on a tough persona and then it's, you know, it kind of stinks, but it is kind of a Tongan thing where we're the tough ones, where you have to be macho, you know, my dad, every time he feels like he's going to cry, he puts on his sunglasses.
Sure.
And then we'll just hold completely still. And so like I had to be that when I was young. And what's interesting is it created this weird thing in me now where when I'm doing a story, I look for a feeling that makes me feel like I'm going to crack that. And when I feel like I'm going to crack that, that's when I chase it as a director now.
Yeah.
Glory made me want to do that. And I'm one of the few people I know of that when I was, how old was I? You know, I was 11.
Yeah.
That I decided I'm going to direct. And I never changed my mind. And that's the weirdest thing about me. And it's the one thing I do know, because I don't think I'm really great at anything, but the one thing I know is I'm terrible at quitting.
Yeah.
I can't quit things. I can't. Yeah. I don't know how to quit. You know, I mean, even, you know, my first divorce, I waited until she's like, maybe we should get divorced. I'm like, yes. You did it. I didn't do it.
I've been thinking about this for a while, but I needed you to pull the trigger.
It's obviously we're not very happy, you know, but I'm glad you're the one that made it change. I didn't quit.
That's right.
You know, and it's sad, but it's like this thing that's built into me.
Yeah.
I don't quit stuff.
And I can relate to that. There's times in my life I feel exactly the same way. Like, something manifests itself and it's like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah.
But I was waiting for you to tell me.
Yeah, I can't quit stuff. And so the thing is, I've been chasing this dream ever since. And I just kind of learned everything else around it. You know, I did the lighting, I did the stage, I did also, anything to keep me in theater, anything to keep me in the arts. But also I did things to like fit in, you know, and it's really weird because I always tell people like, I never care what people think about me. But at the same time, I kind of did because I'd play the piano, but I made sure I could play everything that Dr. Dre had too.
Yeah, and
people like, oh, you're kind of a loser player. I'm like, oh, I did bling, bling.
Yeah.
You know, what? Yeah, it's about Dre now, right?
You know, that's right.
Get going with it and be like, oh, you're cool now. I'm like,
that's right.
Even though I get in my car and I just want to listen to Bach.
Sure, you know?
So
of course.
It's like, whatever.
Well, I'll tell you, he was the influence on Dre too. I mean, these guys are they look at the classics.
Yeah,
so.
Well, and movie scores are my
background.
So, But yeah, so that's kind of a weird route on how I ended up on the stuff. But, you know, it all comes back to my mom, you know, that.
Yeah.
I think she realized that I was different when I listened to her, you know, because she has other kids, you know, she has my, it's funny because she did remarry a white guy dad that came out. So I have the blonde hair, blue eyed brothers and sisters.
Who's also in film, oddly enough.
Yeah. He followed, I want to say he followed me in, but the thing is he took a different route. I'm more of a rebel. I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm going to have fun. He actually went to film school.
Yeah, that's right. You know,
he's a really good producer. If I produce, no one gets paid, but it's good.
Oh, that's awesome.
Where if he produces, it's good. So it's like, okay, Brian, you're smarter.
Yeah, that's right. Shout out to Brian. And I see him at, you know, he wins awards in these, you know, local award shows and so on. Tua K. Aloha and him are linked in. Tua was on the podcast too.
Well, and my mom, like, she gets mad because I don't talk about anything that I get because I tell her, I'm like, there's only one I want.
That's right.
I want an Oscar. Everything else.
Yeah. Secondary.
You know, and that's really like the goal for me now.
That's the competition in you, right?
Well, it's you know.
You don't want to beat anybody, but you want to be on the stage.
Get the Oscar or die trying for it. And really, it's like getting in the front of the stage with the dancers. I want to feel like I can be in the room with them.
Yeah.
That I belong. You know, that's, and not that they accept me, I belong, that I feel like I belong.
Yeah.
And that's the difference.
So you've got this passion for the arts. You go through the dance world, and then you get into this whole, you know, I mean, Hollywood, you know, kind of area, even locally, right? And it starts the Buttercream Gang or working with KSL, doing a television show or commercials and all these things. And you kind of find this little niche of being in front of the cameras, and then you kind of fall in love with being behind the camera.
Yeah.
And then I remember, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it a Lemma that gave you some mentorship when you were at KSL and kind of helped you drive down that road?
Well, you know, he's the one that helped me remember I'm Polynesian, which is sad because I had a little sister pushing it too. But yeah, I when I was 13, they let me cut my first thing, my first edit for KSL. And I knew where I belonged. I knew behind the scenes. Like, I already knew I wanted to be a director, but that was just verifying.
Sure.
You know, and I was annoying to every director that ever put me in as a star. Because I'd just sit and be like, you're a real director. I want to watch you. You know, it's just like, I want to see what real directors do. So when it was after my mission was probably the best excuse of mine to quit acting.
Yeah.
Because I got to do 2 years away.
Yeah.
Even though I was on every video we showed on my mission.
That's right.
Yeah, I was all over them.
But
I got to do 2 years away. When I came back, the only people that really remembered me were people behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And it was perfect. You know, I had a scholarship to UVU, which I just wanted to meet girls. So I was like, I'll take that, you know, and I wanted to produce shows. I barely kept the grades to keep the scholarship, you know?
Yeah.
But then I took the internship at KSL, and that's where Alima kicked in.
Yeah.
And what I loved about Alima is, you know, I'd always been a fan of Vi Sikahema because he was a Tongan and he'd found a niche in this world. And I was an outside kind of watching. And plus, he was in Philly. So it was like, I really can't see him. But Alima, I mean, he wore those suits.
That's right.
He looked slick as ever. Yeah. And then when I get to KSL, he recognizes me. And I swore one day. I swore in the thing. I'm terrible at swearing. Everyone that knows me, I can't. Even when I'm really mad and I swear, people are like, it's just not you, man. You know? So it's like, it doesn't work. It
doesn't fit your vibe, bro.
No, really.
You're too
doesn't.
Nice.
Well, and in my head, I'm like, yeah, my mom's probably crying. I shouldn't do that. But it's like, you know, he pulled me aside. He's like, that's not you. He's like, you know, you need to be you. And then he started talking about being a Polynesian. He's like, you know, you actually have a Polynesian last name.
Yeah.
Like you can do things. And he said that, you know, I could be things, and it really helped boost me.
Yeah.
And you know, when things ended with him at KSL, I was like, I've just been his biggest fan. You know, he seemed to hit people throughout our lives that hit us at the right time.
That's right.
You know, and he's one of them. Like, I will always be loyal to him. I'll always be loyal to you. I'll always be loyal to these people that, I mean, you, come on, Prince is a big deal. You introduced me to Prince. I'm sorry. That's a big deal. I'd seen Prince, but I'd never liked him. You know, and so in Alima, I had a little sister, Mele, who had always, she'd always like tell me, you know, she's
the namesake, huh?
Yeah.
Mele looked up, his daughter, Isaac's daughter, sitting next to her, and she looked up when he said Mele.
My daughter Mele, named after her. But she would always call me because she was just, you know, 4 years younger than me. Yeah, 4 years younger than me. And she would always be like, hey, remember your Tongan? Remember your Tongan? I'm but I'm half Swedish, right. You know? I'm like, all this stuff. And she always made sure I remembered this stuff. And then with her and Alima kicking in, you know, it kicked it into a high gear. And then she died a little while later, you know, when she was 21.
Yeah.
And it suddenly became a bit of an obsession to eventually do something for the Polynesians, which takes me a little bit more to today. But you know, it was like Alima was a big kick on that one.
Yeah.
And KSL, the irony with KSL is that I was there a little too long.
Really?
I guess that's what it was. I got comfortable because I flew up the ranks. I was a huge Stephen Covey fan, so I was like listening to him every day. I'm like, I'm gonna put this to practice, and I went from intern to the head of sports in like less than a year, and so. But then I stayed there.
Yeah.
And it was one of my cousins, Josh James. He's the CEO of Domo. I'm a white side, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he called me up and he's like, that's not what you're doing. I got an offer from, I don't know who told you about it. I got an offer from, you know, some ESPN people and Avid in New York. And I was going to do these things. And he was like, that's not what you want to do.
Really?
I was like, wow, you're right.
Yeah.
It's not what I want to do.
That's right.
And then I talked to my other cousin, Zach James. He started a company called MovieClips.com. And now he has one. It's called Zephyr now that he's CEO of. And he's like, what good is life without risk?
Sure.
And I was like, you know what? Good point. And so
all good things come with risk.
Yeah. Right. So I turned down this dream deal of New York. And then I also quit KSL and said, okay, I think I want to get back to movies.
Yeah.
You know, because KSL was fun and like sports was fun and I was having a lot of fun, but I definitely wasn't fulfilled.
Sure.
And so, and it's funny because within a year I went from, you know, this high life single guy, the youngest to do anything every time I did anything, to the old guy who suddenly, you know, was divorced, living in an office with nothing and homeless and restarting.
Yep.
So, you know, and it's kind of
shake things up, right? I mean,
you got it.
Sets the tone for where everything else went to. And, you know, shout out to Alima and Tao, Harrington Boys. Love those guys. These are people. And I loved being in entertainment when I got in, because I didn't go in until Jan and Brian Clark, bless him too, another brother that passed away way too soon. pushed me into that world and said, you know, Jen would throw me in her car and take me to Lagoon or, you know, wherever, and Center Street and all these things. They're the ones that made me do it because I just didn't have the discipline and I didn't care. And even when I was hired, I kind of felt bad because I didn't care while I was there.
Dude, same thing. I mean, why do you think I hate, you know, my biggest problem was is like, I didn't think I was good.
That's right.
I get a job. I'm like, I shouldn't be here. There's so many good ones here.
They call that imposter syndrome. By the way, I've learned that in the last 6 months.
Really?
There's a psychological term called imposter syndrome. And a lot of people have it. I don't know if I can say the majority of human beings have it, but we never believe that we are as great as we are, which is such a farce because we are. We've all got greatness within, no matter who you are in this light and so on. But they call it imposter syndrome, where you're always worried that somebody's going to catch on that you're not as good as they think you are.
Holy cow. Right?
So you have to look this up, imposter syndrome. I just barely learned about the term like 6 months ago and bought all these books and I was fascinated by it. But now I try to tell myself, Carl, no, you really are decent at what you're doing. Don't worry, because you over-obsess. But it's funny because I think these people pull our potential out of us, right? Yeah. They see where we're worth. And I loved like somebody like Roz, because she'd be like, oh, Isaac's busy. Hey, Carl, why don't you come over here because you'll look. And that's always how it went.
I mean, let's face it. You and I were, there was two LDS teen TV shows on at the same time.
And we were the hosts.
We were the hosts of both of them, you know? You go to,
shout out to
they brought me into Center Street for one day, and they're like, well, we can't have both of them on the same show. And so,
plus Abe Mills. I mean, come on, there's way too much diversity.
We got the
here.
One black guy.
That's
we got
right.
The, you know, so they put me on the other show. And I always thought it was funny. I was with Bob Evans.
Yeah, that's
that
right.
One, so.
That's right. Marissa was on that too, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was. Actually.
I thought so.
Yeah,
I remember.
I forgot about that one. It's like all the minorities of Utah.
That's right. That we're all friends. They just cast us in all these things. It's great.
It's just like all those movies where like, I'm the token black and I'm the token. I'm the token. Yeah.
Isaac's busy. Call Carl. They look the same.
Oh, shoot. Man.
I love it. So then you get into this world. These guys kind of groom you. Then you say, I'm going to kind of pivot into this world of, you know, filmmaking and, you know, be behind the camera and so on. And then you started kind of cutting your own thing and eventually led up to your big break in releasing your first big movie. Yeah. And, you know, I guess it's taking a step back from that. You also got, I think before the movie is when you started working with like Imagine Dragons and doing their whole, you know, biographic and all that stuff. Tell us about how you started to kind of get, you know, you leave KSL, you find yourself homeless, divorced, having all these challenges. And how did you own the upswing? Because at that time is a very, very dark time. And I've talked about it on this podcast. I've talked about it publicly. There was a time when I was 19, 20 years old where I was ready to commit suicide. I was very depressed and I just felt like I wasn't, the world would be better without you. And you have all these real negative thoughts and none of it's true, but you just feel so down on yourself that I was like ready to off myself and just say, listen, the world's better without me. But it's not because you don't have friends or you've got all this circle of love and people and so on, but you're just internally feel so alone. How did you, instead of falling into this slump and saying, okay, I'm just going to, you know, whatever it is, give up, or I'm just going to stick with KSL and keep doing what's comfortable. How did you separate and then say, now I'm going to own my destiny and turn into what you, the beautiful life that you've got now with Bianca and your kids? How did you make that happen out of the challenge?
You know, I, you know, it's weird. You know, being a kid that came from divorce, I think it starts with like my girls and you know, these two, because I didn't think I'd do it. I didn't think I'd be divorced. Of course, I didn't want to get married either. I wanted kids, but I didn't want marriage. I was like, crap, I got to get one with the other. So I don't know how I'm going to work it. But there I was, I couldn't see my kids. And you know, I named one after my sister that died and the other one sneakily after her too. And so it was like, you know, it was hard. But what's interesting is that, you know, it actually goes backwards. When I was in high school, there's a friend of mine, we weren't tight in high school, but we really respected each other. And he was like the popular guy and cool and this tall white dude, Matt Easton. And I was the video nerd. Like you go through our yearbook, I'm with a video camera I'm with the radio guys or I'm with all that stuff. And in college we connected and I was put in charge of all broadcasting at UVU. And the first thing I did was like, I want to work with people I like. And I knew he works. And so I called him. I'm like, dude, well, he was in one of my classes. I'm like, hey, Matt, you want a scholarship?
Yeah.
So I was in charge of 12. And he's like, sure, for what? I'm like, video. He's like, what do I do? I'm like, I'll teach you. Yeah. And it's, and thing is like, the one thing I knew is he had a face and a personality for a star.
Yeah.
And in a way, it was like, maybe it was the beginning of me like finding what I really, really like doing in this industry, because I didn't care if he was good. I just knew I liked him and I knew I could turn him into something. I knew I could help him become something.
Yeah.
And he gripped it. He learned it faster than I could teach it to him. And now he's also one of the top directors in Utah.
Wow.
Well, and you know, he does Nickelodeon, all the Lagoon commercials are him.
Sure.
You know, he does, you know, he won the MTV award actually for the video, the Believer video.
Wow.
He did for Imagine Dragons. But it's funny because, so I kind of get, help him give this kick, and then I go off to KSL and he kind of just keeps doing his own thing.
Yeah.
I come back, my whole world does what it does. And then there he is.
Yeah.
Just this friend of mine that
just
like,
positioned.
That was like, you know, he
perfectly.
Just, yeah, he's still doing it. And and he's like, yeah, I'm working for this company, but I'm also doing these free music videos. And I was like, dude, I want in.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like, and you know, some of my favorite directors, like Anton Fuqua and mm-hmm. others that came from music videos, you know.
Yeah. But, I mean, Spike Jones and some of these people, I mean, that's how they got their, kind of got their thing, right?
Well,
just kind of doing music videos and then they start doing all these cool things.
Spike's special, you know, like, that's the thing, like Spike, I will never compare myself to Spike. You know,
yeah,
Spike's
sure.
the man. But anyway, they came from music videos. Like, this is a good route for me. Why not try it out? And he, man, that kid works. Like, I had no idea what kind of monster he turned into. And, mm-hmm. and he killed me. We were working hard for free.
Yeah, right.
Like, and we did like 50 free music videos for whatever. And two of those were Neon Trees and Imagine Dragons.
Yeah.
And BYU TV gave us a TV show because of his concept he came up with. And so it was called Audio Files. And we did that show.
Okay.
And this all happened. Like, I was sitting in my office with just a laptop and no camera. And he's just like, hey, you want to help me with this stuff? Let's just do it. I'm like, yeah. And the first thing I direct is Imagine Dragons, their first big hit, you know, music video. It was an acoustic video we shot in Provo.
Yeah.
And from that point on, you know, I directed documentary, and then I get a call from, they sign while we just happen to be doing that documentary.
Sure.
On them. And then the label's like, who was doing your videos?
Yeah.
And so the band's like, hey, do you want to come live with us? We only got this much money. And I'm just like, I'm homeless anyway. It doesn't matter. So I go move into the Palms down in Vegas while they do their first album. And then do a documentary that was purchased by VH1. You saw that. I remember you texted
I watched
me.
It. Oh, yeah. I took a picture of the screen where right at the end, it goes black. And then Isaac Colasima pops up on the screen. I was like, and I got emotional. Like, wow, he's made it.
Yeah. And I'm just like, I'm so poor. But look, yes.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, and it happened with that. Because they made a lot of money on that. And then I did the Demons video, which got nominated.
Yeah, which was incredible. The Demons video, the Gold video too, right?
Yeah, Gold's my favorite one.
Yeah, you know? I love the Gold video.
Because I got to be a choreographer on that one
with
the lights. But,
but so awesome.
But like, but the Demons one, what was special for me on that one was getting nominated for the MTV award. I told my mom when I was a kid that one day I'd be at MTV.
Yeah.
And she was just like, I don't know. How could you do that without letting go of your morals and all that stuff? And I was like,
you're the real world, actually.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And there it was. I'm sitting in the forum at the time, and there's my name just huge on the screen in front of Beyonce and all these superstars and everything. I was like, no one can pronounce that Tongan name they're seeing right now. It's like, this is a moment. And then after that, I think is where they kind of, things kind of happen funny with them is just because they took me to Hong Kong with them because they'd done some music for Transformers.
Oh, got it.
And Transformers 4. And so I was working with Paramount to do a behind the scenes music video. And I got to know Steve Jablonski, who does all the scoring for all their movies.
Okay.
And then they took me into the green room and I sat at a table with Michael Bay.
Wow.
Who was it? And it was weird because I was like, crap, that's Michael Bay. But movie people, all you got to do is mention movies and you just talk. And next thing you know, he and I are just jabbering. I'm just like, I can't believe I'm jabbering. Like, this guy's like my friend now.
Yeah.
And then in comes Mark Wahlberg. Every other word's the F word. I'm like, Boston, Boston, you know? And then like Kelsey Grammer, like all of them come walking in. We're all just talking movies like we're pals from the old times. And some of them like, they're like, hey man, dude, haven't we worked together? I'm like, never.
That's right.
It's like, I live in Utah.
That's
I'm like,
right.
Nowhere near you guys. And I left that room going, I can't do music anymore.
Yeah.
I'm done. And so I finished my stuff with them and that was that.
Yep.
And wrote my movie.
Yeah.
You know, and went chase the investors and came up with the movie. So that's how that happened. That's the long version. But I'd say like what saved me was that weird scenario of that friend, Matt Easton. And we're still tight today. Like we still text each other. It's ironic because we don't hire each other anymore because we're both directors.
That's right.
And we don't want to make the other one not direct.
Right.
You know, and it's, and thing is, he's so freaking talented. I had no idea. Like, I'd put him in commercials when we were in high school.
Yeah.
And I thought he was one of the funniest, most talented people I'd ever seen if he just learned some technical things.
Sure.
Because me, I was obsessed with, you know, like Tony Scott. I love Tony Scott.
Sure, of course.
And like,
Scott
Free. Stylizing and all that stuff. And I was like, man, if he just learns this stuff, he's
going
to go nuts. And now he's huge. He's a big deal. You know, and it's, man, he was...
Right place at the right time when you needed him, huh?
And he bought a camera and handed it to me and said, look, and I still have it, you know, and I still use it, actually. Yeah. And yeah, I owe my life to that guy. You know, it's really weird, but I owe my life to so many people. Like, because they all, it's the weirdest thing when you look back in your life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean,
I think about this all the time. In fact, we talk about Jan and Callahan, some of these people. These are people that were there at pivotal moments in my life. I mean, I lived with Jan in Jan's basement, you know, as a kid. While she was out working and doing her thing, I was just living, like, inhabiting her basement by myself, and I was like 16, 17, 18 years old.
Look at you, even like your life, like what you've gone through. Like,
that's a whole wild mess. It turned out great, but the whole thing was just like, I'm like, yeah, I've lived a kind of a wild life.
But I loved it, man. I've loved watching your journey on this stuff too. Like, you know, I think part of what drives me and some of my stuff is that is a lot of people really did believe in me. Like, they're like, wow, there's something weird about you. And it's like, you can either like let that crush you or just go like, no, I'm gonna do something with this.
That's right.
You know, and so that's kind of in the end, because there was Roz. You know, and I don't know if you ever knew Rox Hasegawa.
Yeah, of course.
You know, like she really, like, the plan was for her to be a manager for me, and when she died, it was brutal for me. But like, you know, she was there for everything. Like, she was giving me guidance. She was like, when I did the Real Salt Lake thing, I always wanted to do something iconic for my home state.
Yeah.
You know, so now I got two things with this and Dry Bar. But it's like, you know, she was there for all that.
That's right.
You know, and she was even on set for, right before she died, she was on set for my movie for the final scene, the big tear scene. And she had a long talk on that.
I remember you posting and talking about that. She was a great lady.
Well, yeah. And you know, it's funny though, when you really.
But she was a believer too. You know what I mean? She was a believer.
She did. Like she, and what I like is they're the kind of believers that aren't going to push you into something. But if you ask, if you say like, man, I really want to do this, you're like, I can put you there. You know,
that's right.
And I've wanted to be that for other people ever since then. Like, I feel like that's the only way you can be happy is doing that kind of stuff. You know?
Yeah, that's exactly. And I think about my life, and that's, you know, I mean, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing now, is because I look at it and I think there were pivotal people at pivotal moments in my life, you know, and there are people that you never see again sometimes. Like, you know, they were there at such a critical time, and they were there for the span of a couple months, maybe a year, 2 years, and then you don't even talk to them anymore.
Yeah.
But they were the ones that you needed at that time in your life that just catapulted you. And whether it's they believed in you, they saw your potential. I mean, I think about the Powers family, right? Yeah. I mean, I lived with them before my mission, and I lived I was just like, this guy lived on people's couches, lived in their basements. I was just like this nomad. But I mean, I learned so much, and all these people would just embrace me, bring me into their homes. And, you know, I think of Candace Powers and Gary Powers, when, you know, Sydney's parents, you know, when we were doing on stage, and, you know, they'd just be in the, you know, Candace would be in the corner just like, oh, we love Carl. And I remember Mark Miller came home from his mission and said, hey, I want to go and hang out with Sydney and these people. And I remember going up there, and we're just having a conversation with Candace. She's like, what are you doing now? And I was like, oh, it's all before my mission, before I'd even, you know, started to even investigate the church. And she says, come and live with us. And I'm like, what? So I just come and live in our basement. Scott just got home from a mission, and you can spend time with him. And that was like the greatest time of my life, because I was trying to transition out of kind of this, you know, troublemaker kind of, you know, partying and doing all these things I did in my life with no direction. You know, with all these people believing me, because I've always had people believed in me. I had a million jobs. I mean, I was, and you know, they'd fire me, but they'd say, come back later, you know, and kick me out of school, but they love me. You know, it's kind of this weird thing.
You were really good at everything you did.
But it was fun because I never really believed in myself, you know? And so it's kind of always, I was just this nomad, because I was like, yeah, I don't really know what I like. I'm lost. And you know, Candace pegged me in, and then all of a sudden I become friends with Scott, and, you know, you go off to, you know, BYU while he's up there, and you start spending time with all these good guys and girls, and you're like, this is just a great way of life. Like, you people are so unique and different than me, but I'm learning, and they believe in you, and they, you know, they kind of prime you. So at all these different pivotal points in my life, much like you're talking about, there's just those people that believe in you or see your potential and just want to be around you. And you draw off of that energy from them. And that's kind of how we go through life, right? Is, you know, your relationship with this gentleman, you know, and your relationship and how it goes, he was able to kind of own that upswing with you and help you. But you were there obviously at a time in his life that kind of crafted where he's at. And so we all kind of just, you know, link arms together at different times and just kind of grow each other. And that's what it's all about.
You know, I never think about it being there for him. I just needed, I was just trying to make sure the news program was better than it was. But you know, it's, you know, that's a really good point. You know, what's funny is when you think back to, like, at least for me, I've always felt one of my pillar important ones for me in the end is like recognizing when I can.
Yeah.
Like trying to just recognize the people that are there is making sure I can just hurry and thank them for where I'm at. But the big one for me really in the end when I go back is my mom. It's kind of funny. My mom is like the pillar of everything for me. I think she's this, and it's weird because our relationship's different nowadays. Like, we don't talk as much as we used to anymore, but, you know, I'll go to battle for her.
Of course.
And everything, it goes back to a lesson. And I don't know, I'm probably just all over the place on you right now.
This is what it's about.
It kind of reminds me of...
the human experience is all over the place.
Because it kind of reminds me, like, your life, like, you did what feels good. And you went with it until it was like, no, maybe not. And you moved on. Like, it's a unique personality that can handle going, okay, I got to cut ties because I don't know. You know, and it's like...
It was weird.
Yeah, and people around you are probably going like... But you're good at, like me, like, honestly, I did not try DJing again after I heard you. Because I was like, I'm good, but I'm not like that.
Yeah, and it's funny because that was a passion for a period of time. And I'll tell you what, I haven't touched turntables in 5 years.
Oh, man, you were good.
But it's just, but you just lose the passion for it and you redirect, right? Yeah. And I look at my kids now and I'm like, listen, I could be DJing or I could be spending time with my kids and coaching kindergarten soccer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Your passions just change through life. And I still have a love of music, but it's nothing like it used to be. You know what I mean? Because we go through these, I don't know if they're phases, but there are times when we really need them. And there's times where music was my best friend, right? And it's just, you connect so emotionally to, you know, the music. Now it's like, I don't need that to connect to. And I still have an appreciation for those things and I still love them, but now I've got this whole different world that I connect to. You know what I mean? And you kind of just look for these things and they come at times. So it's really interesting the way that Al kind of changes as we go along.
No, you're right. You know, and it's kind of getting what I was talking about. Like, it's kind of funny that when I talk to like my stepson right now, you know, we're working with him because I've noticed he doesn't know what he loves. And it's weird because for me, I've noticed that a lot of people I talk to, I try to go back like, okay, this is what you're doing. So let's go backwards. Why are you doing it? Why are you doing it? Until you finally get, because it feels good. It's like, it's like your favorite food. You eventually can't say why. It's
right.
Just like it.
Right.
You know? And so it's like, whenever I hit someone, like, they're like, oh, I do it because of this, because it makes these people happy. I'm like, then that's not good.
That's right.
It's like, you're not doing it because, you know, me, I dance because, man, it just felt good. And the smiles made it better. And the idea is like that gets into the thing that's always made fun of in film is the motivation, right?
Yep.
Like, actors, what's my motivation?
That's right. That's right.
But what's funny is like, it goes to the greatest lesson my mom ever taught me. And I think, I don't know if I've ever told you about it. It's something I explain to a lot of actors when I work with them because I love helping actors. I love working with actors. I love helping them get good at their stuff and then promising them, you will not look bad.
Yeah.
I am going to make you look like you feel like you're going to look, you know? Yeah. My mom, when I was really little, she'd take me to art galleries. Obviously, none of the other kids that took, but me, for her little brown athletic boy, did. And she'd have me look at a painting and say, what do you feel?
Yeah.
And she would, and I'd be like, I don't know. It's like a really cool painting. So let's get up to the painting now. And she'd walk up to the painting and she'd say, look at the brush strokes.
Yeah.
And so we'd look at the brush strokes and we'd look and you could see where they go long, where they go short, where they go wide. And
wow.
My mom is an incredible artist.
Yeah.
And she'd be like, you could tell. See, look, this is where they tried hard. This is where they were. This is where they were like, oh, they cared right here. Look, they care about whatever's going on here. And you go back and suddenly it's like this collage of emotions.
Yeah.
And it's become like this thing where the motivation is everything now to everything I do. When I direct now, it's like I work with the actors. I'm like, you know, like, well, this is what I say. I'm like, hey, how would you say this? But don't read me the freaking line. Just
feel it,
you know? And the same thing goes now with everything in my life. Like when I talk to my kids, when I talk to anyway, I'm like, well, what's underneath this?
Yeah.
There's layers in everything. And so it's, you know, art to me is just like this thing I grip to now.
Yeah.
I think it's what I hold on to emotionally. It's what I hold on to because it's like, it's the only thing that kind of lifts me out of darkness. And it's, and like, I mean, I don't even know. I don't know how I made it.
Well, it's interesting because so you go down that road and you talk about these brush strokes. Now, I was just looking up. I forgot the gentleman's name, and I wouldn't be expected to remember it. But the main character in Last Descent, John, is it?
John.
John. Yeah. John. Okay. Yeah. So John, so you look at this character, right? This person, this human being that's now passed on, so on. And I remember I felt so privileged to be invited to the screening of this movie with you and Jen and I dressed up. I wore a tux and did the whole deal. I was so excited to be there. Got your autograph.
I know.
It was a lot of fun.
Like, chuck the pin at you.
That's right. I was so excited. But it's, I remember when the cast was talking about it and it was really cool. Cause I remember after the film went, we all clapped and then you guys all sat in the front and they did a little Q&A kind of deal and people talk. And you also opened it up and did a preface. But in talking about that, I remember there was a part and I can't remember exactly what was said. But I remember you were talking, one of the actors or actresses that was up there had said something about that, like talking to you and understanding how that scene would feel, and also talking to his wife, John's wife, and understanding how those emotions went and so on to put context around these scenes. And I was like, that's incredible. That is so incredible to think about. I have chicken skin thinking about it right now.
Well, it's funny. It's a thing I like to do that Edgar Wright does, and it's definitely the dancer in me taking over, because you know, I've always said the dance is the purest personal form of art possible when you really get into it, because you are taking emotion and turning it into physical movement.
That's right.
And if you do it well, people feel something.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. It's like the most amazing thing about art. It's like packed up feelings. And so with my scripts, all my movies, all the things I've done, whatever you see me behind the scenes, I've got headsets on.
Yeah.
And it's because I've assigned songs to every single page of the script. And I tell, you know, and that's what I have playing on repeat whenever we're doing whatever. And like, sometimes I'll have the actors listen to it. Sometimes I don't, you know, and like,
that creates about, that motivation though, right? Yeah, or like, the purpose. Like,
that actor in particular was a little bit new to him because it's something that Edgar Wright does in his movies too. When I heard he did it, I'm like, no, I mean, cool, but oh, I do too. You know, but it was like, and I love Edgar Wright. You know, he's actually a really good editor too. Side note, but I told him, like, you know, like there's one scene when he's leaving the cave, and I started playing, like, okay, this will never play. In fact, I don't think I'll have music in this scene. I'm like, but listen to this. And I put on Halo, you know, from Beyonce.
Yeah.
And it changed the way that he would turn his head. And
absolutely.
It changed the way he would do things. But then the scene when he sees the baby, I told everyone, no one talk to him. No one look at him. No one bother him. Let him do whatever he needs to do.
Yeah.
And I said, we can only do this in one take. We did two, but we could only do one take on this thing, because I want him to know that whatever we get, we're going to get.
It's raw. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, that's the underneath that you're talking about there.
And it's funny too, because the dance piece, I was just looking this up too. There's a movie called The Haumana, and it's on Netflix, and it's all about the ancient Hawaiian dance, right? It's the hula. And it's about this guy who goes out and is teaching the hula. And then, you know, a lot of the, you know, the elders get it, you know, people get upset because it's like, no, it's not just dance. And he's trying to say, no, this is what it means. And this is really what it is. And they're saying, no, this is the ancient form. And it's like, no, but this is the beauty behind it. And so there's this almost struggle between sacredness between the hula and what he's trying to show emotionally through the hula. It's a real, real beautiful film. Really cool deal. But that's kind of what you're explaining, which I think is so cool.
Hawaiian culture, Polynesian, but Hawaiian really in particular is so deep. There's so many layers in the language and so many. I've been studying so much. I'm just like, you guys, like, your words are art. Like, your dances are art. Everything you guys do is art. Tongans, I think we just killed people, but you guys were like, you guys were like emotionally.
Civilization, man.
They were doing things that, you know, you look at aloha, like the true meaning of aloha.
Yeah.
Where you touch heads and the alo coming from your soul, and then
the breath.
It's giving part of yourself to the person.
That's right.
Like, when you know what that is.
Yeah, you're sharing the air.
It's like, holy cow, I need to honor what this person just did to me.
That's right.
You know, and it's. I mean, the Hawaiian people are special. They are. When they really grasp onto what their Hawaiian culture is and how deep it really is and the layers, it's like, man, I just...
Beautiful.
It makes sense at that place that Hawaii is very special to so many people in the world.
Right.
You know, because there's just something there. Yeah. It's just there, you know, and you know, I've been blessed on my latest project to be there so much over the last time, like little bit. And I feel like I grew, like, as an artist, I grew, but I feel like I grew up. I learned so much about a culture that I until Lima, I didn't even care about. I shouldn't say I didn't care. I just didn't really look to go into.
Absolutely. It. Absolutely.
You know, and studying this guy, Duke Kahanamoku, that I've been studying now, one thing that I feel like has been a mistake in my life that I'm trying to figure out how to do right is that I used to get mad when people would ask about my culture, like when they'd ask about my brown skin, which was so obvious, you know, but it was like, I wanted to be Isaac, the director, Isaac, the artist, not the Tongan artist.
That's right. The Tongan director. You and I share that in the same vein where I'm always not offended, but I'm always like, listen, there's parts of me that I say I want to represent the Polynesian culture and so on. There's other things, but I don't want that to define me necessarily. But I do want to own it. And I want to make sure that I'm, you know, following my father and making him proud and generations that come before. But at the same time, I don't want that to be why I'm in the room, right? Once I'm in the room, I want it to be known. And I want to represent it. But I don't want it to be the catalyst for why this is, you know, the driving behavior behind it.
It's the competitive spirit. It's the, you know, the fact that we both are people that say like, oh, I don't belong here.
Yeah.
It says a lot because when they were doing that whole Oscars so white thing for a while there, I was getting mad at people. I'm like, no, because that means like if I ever get nominated, people will think I'm there.
And I never want that to be the case.
Yeah. Yep.
That's what I say.
I want to be able to sit with those other directors and be like, hey,
I belong here.
We're a frat.
And you know I belong here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and that scares me because it's like, but at the same time, studying what Duke has done and the way Duke approached, you know, presenting what it's like to be a Polynesian and the greatest athlete in the world at the time.
Yeah.
Was really, really interesting. He wasn't just the greatest swimmer in the world. He was this Hawaiian, and somehow he found a way to make both level. It was like it actually made him cooler.
Yeah.
It wasn't what made him unique. It made him just cooler to everybody. I mean, you look at it, some of the most racist times out there in America, and yet people are walking around with Hawaiian shirts wishing they were these brown people on the island.
Yeah.
You know, and so like this guy figured it out.
Yeah.
And it's one thing I've been wanting to do because, you know, like you said, like I said, like I'd spent so much of my time. People are like, yeah, so you're the Tongan. Like people, I was, you know, they're saying I was the first. Well, I was the one of the first. It's kind of like, you know, the Super Bowl when two black coaches became the first black coaches.
That's right.
Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Two Polynesians nominated for director the same year, same category in the MTV Awards.
Yeah.
And then the other guy won. Go figure. Freaking Maori, you know, but it's like, you know, they say, oh, the Tongan. I'm just like, I'm an artist, you know?
Yeah. That's what I was saying. I'm an American.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, but it's also comforting to know there's people that are on a huge platform today, like Dwayne Johnson, who is still talking about this today, saying, I get guff from the Samoan side about the black, and then I get the African-American people getting mad at me about highlighting the Samoan. You get the Samoan tattoo, but what about African-American pride? And it's kind of comforting to me, like, okay, this guy is on a major stage having to kind of deal with that, you know, not an identity crisis, but just a cultural, you know, trying to find out where you fit in.
But I mean,
but he's doing it too. And I'm like, okay, cool. I'm in a room with a handful of us that we're all just trying to navigate through these waters, especially when race is such a huge topic. Even this week,
I know.
Race being such a huge topic. It's like, oh no, now we're going back to the 1800s. Good grief. You know what I mean? With some of this thought. And it's like,
well, and the hard part is like, it's when they attack race now, especially, you know, you and me, we're half, you know, it's one thing for someone to be like, oh, you're this. It's another thing when everything everybody says attacks what makes you who you are.
That's right.
Like on both sides.
Yeah.
And you can't do it. Like I'd sit with these one groups, all my homies, you know, and they'd be like, dude, white people this, white people. I'm like, my mom's not like that, guys.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, how do you say your mom? I'm like, you said white people.
That's right.
My mom.
That's me, man. I'm a Fijiwegian.
Yeah. and then they'd be the other guy, man, they're so lazy over there. I'm like, dude, like that's, have you seen my skin? Come on. Like, you know, it's really... You know, in the end, I like the way you put it. We're Americans.
That's what we are. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, my dad tried to get to the United States and build a life for his family. That's what we're here. We're here to live the dream.
Dude, both our dads. We're sons of immigrants.
That's right.
It's so much so that we almost forget sometimes. I do at times.
We still honor the elders, honor our heritage and so on. But it's just like I feel about my kids. I want them to have a greater life than I had. And I want their kids to have a greater life than my kids had. And it's just, that's the dream, right? Yeah. We want to grow.
You know, I've been asked, you know, because it is funny, like, I guess my family was somewhat of something in Tonga because for whatever reason, like when the islands were united, our family fell and the oldest of the family would have to go be with the king and change his last name so that the oldest wasn't with the people, whatever. That falls on me after my uncle dies. I become the one. And so technically I'm supposed to change my last name according to Tonga and all this stuff. I don't know how it's going to go.
Just make it a wrap. It's just like Sokia, right? Our family took on the name Sokia. Our real last name is Tokailangi, which is my middle name. And then my grandfather took on the name Sokia, you know, because there was an elder that, you know, helped raise him, that he honored him and took his name. So, but then my dad's family, all him and his siblings are all Sokias, but that's the only Sokias there are. And then out of that generation, all his brothers either didn't have kids or had girls. And so it fell to my dad, and my dad has one boy, and I've got six daughters, so I'm like the last living Sokia, right? Oh, I mean, that's on the male side to pass on the name, and I'm not going to have any boys. We're done. Yeah. You know, it's all girls, and so it's kind of like, yeah, but oh well, who cares? It is what it is. You know, because it's a heritage culture thing. I'm like, listen, it's a name. You know, we're all just, we've got the blood. Who cares?
Well, it's funny.
It's a different day.
So what are you going to honor? And I was like, well, I feel like I'm kind of like Canada, where the queen is still the head of the Commonwealth, but I'm over here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I ain't paying taxes to the queen right now.
Yeah, and I am an American. You know, at the same time, we have family that have fought in the wars. We support our, you know, and this honestly, this is a country where I don't think we could have done what we do. You know, when I look at how a lot of other countries work, especially being able to, like, the blessing of what I do, I've been able to travel all over the world and see how things go. And there's times where I hear people complaining here. I'm like, man, you have not been anywhere. It's like when I come home, I see that flag and I just want to bawl. Yeah. Like, it's just like, oh my gosh, I'm home. Where like, I don't feel like scared all the time.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm scared of other people. It's just like, there's things in governments. You don't
unrest.
Know.
It's just unrest.
Yeah. And you know, with as much craziness that's here, at least I see it. I know it, you know, and I know the people leading the charges and all that. So I'm like, okay, I understand this. I understand that.
I say that too. I always say about the U.S. I'm like, hey, you can go to other countries, but I know our laws and I'm familiar with our government and so on. And I don't know, the rules somewhere else. Like, you know, you go to Mexico and we hear all these horror stories. People cross the border, they get arrested for nothing. And it's like, give me $1,000 and I'll let you go. And it's like, well, at least in the U.S., hopefully that won't happen. I mean, what's happened recently with the police situation in Minnesota and so on kind of challenges that ideology. You know, the people that we've hired to protect and service aren't necessarily doing that. But I think it's more common in other countries, and that's what scares me is, well, at least in the U.S., we have a little bit of checks and balances, more so than I think a lot of other places.
Well, and I think our country's in the mood right now to polarize stuff by race, and it drives, but what's interesting, it does put us in both of us, in a very interesting situation where we can serve as bridges, or we can't, like, where we accidentally become my mom's not like that, because people will never want to tear on your mom.
That's right.
You know?
Well, and that's where I'm funny, because I take that and I go, you know, if people say, well, are you going to fight for the minorities? Are you going to fight for the, you know, the white people? And I'm like, I'm fighting for the Mormons. I'm just going to default to religion. I'm going to take a step backward, and I'm just going to go in a different way.
I always say the Swangans. I'm just like,
that's why I'm a Fijiweegian. I'm a Fijiweegian. Fijiweegians.
Yeah. Although I do think it's funny that I technically, ancestrally, I'm the huge Tongan warriors and the huge Vikings.
That's what I say. I say the Fijians are known as warriors, and so are the Norwegians. So
you got
both sides. So now that's why I've got my temper problem, because, as you know, you got some very, very high octane individuals that put the blood into me.
And I guess I'm just a spiritual artist.
There it is.
I don't know. I would have been dead on a battlefield in both cultures. You know.
I hear you, brother. So tell us, I guess, just kind of wrap us up, because I know you've got to go and you've got your beautiful girls sitting here waiting. Okay. So you put out Last Descent. It has a lot of success. You know, you do these things. When is it going to come out on like Netflix and so on? Are you partnering with them to have it more distributed?
It's on Amazon. I know that. You know, but that's a movie, like, you know, working with my... Luckily, it got my investor paid back, so I still have a perfect record there.
Yeah.
But it is on Amazon right now, and it was made mostly because I wanted to do something that I knew, like, people would have a hard time watching in the theater, and they do. It's heavy.
It's really heavy. For those that haven't seen it yet, make sure you go out, pick it up at locally in Utah, Deseret Book. I mean, I see it all over the wall, and I take pictures and text them to Isaac, like, look, here's The Last Descent. But it's, very heavy. Story about a gentleman who is in a Nutty Putty cave with his brother. And I'd never heard the story before you'd made the film. I remember hearing a story about somebody getting stuck in an Nutty Putty cave and I'm closing, but I didn't know like the entire, you know, breadth of the story. But it goes through, and this gentleman's going through just kind of spelunking with his brother and ends up getting stuck. And they end up calling in all these teams to come in and get him out, and they don't get him out. And the gentleman individually, you know, ends up dying, but they couldn't even get him out. He's stuck in the Nutty Putty cave still today. And so they sealed it and nobody's allowed to go in there anymore. And this is the whole story about, you know, him and his family and his wife, and, you know, I mean, it's just so beautifully done. I was bawling, but it was such an emotional roller coaster. But it was such a beautifully told story, and it's a story that I felt, wow, I'm so glad it edified me in being able to kind of be through this whole experience. Well, you know what I mean?
And it kind of leans on what I hope to be making. Like, I'm drawn to things that I hope, I don't know, if, I hope will make people feel inspired or awake. I believe that the purpose of arts is for people to feel. Yes. And that's the reason arts need to exist, so we can be reminded we're human.
Yep.
And with that one, it was pretty scary, because, you know, the way I toy with the ending, where I take it more, if you're LDS, you kind of understand some of the area I take it into it.
Yep.
Because I kind of go a little Saturday's Warrior in part of it, but it's like talking to his widow and pitching that to her, saying like, look, what I wanted him to do, because the newspaper articles would always tell his entire life how this, like, literally the picture perfect guy would die. And so the idea was like, we'll use that moment for his son to learn about his dad.
Yeah.
You know, and not know that he's right before he's born, that's why it plays in that whole Saturday's Warrior. But if you understand the premortal existence, the LDS, you know, but it's, you know, it was pretty hard to ask her to do that, but she loved it. And of course, when I'm pitching to her, I'm crying and she's crying.
Of course.
And then I'm seeing the actual kids there. And they're crying. And I'm just like going like, oh my gosh, I can't do this. You know? And so that's of course why I started it. You know, with a comedy club and comedy specials after that. So enough crying. We're going
to
make
shout out to Dry Bar Comedy, by the way. And I have to tell you a side note, I always talk about Dry Bar Comedy with people, and it comes up in the weirdest context. I was in California and I was going to to do a big conference with this one of my clients that I was working with at the time. And I'm in California, and my Uber driver starts talking. He's like, you know what show I like to watch? And I was like, this is so weird. My Uber driver's just like talking about this random, and I'm not even talking. I'm like messaging or whatever. And yeah. He goes, you know what show I like to watch? And I said, what? And he goes, I love Dry Bar Comedy. I was like, this is the weirdest conversation ever. So I'm trying to FaceTime Isaac. I'm like, well, I know a guy that's responsible for that show. Let me talk to him. And it's just funny that going off this segment, it's like, you know, the influence that some of the projects you've had and where they've gone have just been so fun.
Well, it's funny, like, if you Google my name, well, not Google, if you go to Amazon and you type in my name, the last of Sam pops up, and then it's all comedy. It's like, oh, he's making up. He's making up for it. Like, my IMDb is
here's the heavy stuff, and here's all the comedy.
Look, you'll just laugh. You'll laugh from all this stuff. You
That's right.
Well, because I believe in comedians. Comedians, I think, are probably part of the reason I survived my childhood. Like, I was a huge George Carlin and Eddie Murphy fan growing up.
Yeah.
Partially because of you, too.
Yeah, I love Eddie, man. And so it's Eddie. Like, Ron Delirious, are two of the greatest ever to stand.
Raw, man. And thing is that I feel like comedians need to be protected, but I also felt like I wanted to see stuff that I could watch with my mom.
Yeah.
Again, my driving force for everything I do.
Right.
And so that's where that whole show came up with. But yeah, you know, my mom is the driving force of everything. Now I think about it. It's kind of funny. It's kind of weird, actually.
Yeah.
Well, it goes back to, you know, when I was a kid, like, we got in a car wreck. You remember that?
That's I remember that. I totally remember that. I remember seeing your mom after that.
Yeah. And she just was always like, you're supposed to do things. You're supposed to be. And everything she said, I ate it. I'm like, hey, mom. Because when my mom would say, like, you know, you can be anything you want to be. I'm going to be this. And I have to, because I'm not going to make my mom a liar.
Yeah.
You know, so I have to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, all the way down to, like, my mom had a chance to meet Spielberg once. And she's like, no, Isaac will introduce me someday. And so I'm like, I think about it, honestly, every single day. I'm like, man, someday I'm going to have to take the most talented, influential person in my life. And you know, introduce,
right.
You know, and introduce her to Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Oh, but you know, I'll say that in a Tonight Show someday. Hopefully.
Yeah.
But,
hey, it'll happen.
But you know when it comes to all this stuff I've done with all this comedy and stuff, I think part of it's giving back to this home state. Like, I really like where we live. I like the way we grew up.
Love it.
We got lucky. You know, when I look at the rest of the world, like, even just America, and even just this time period, like we grew up with the world where we were a little more carefree.
Yeah.
Just having fun.
Which is funny. I hover over my kids all the time. They have watches that have GPS and everything. I need to know where they are every 15 seconds. And I'm like, there would be like a full day when my parents are at work. And I was like riding my bike around this. I was in West Valley, like riding around like to Corey Carver's, like an hour and a half away from my house on a bike. We didn't have cell phones. You know what I mean? It was just kind of like... And just as long as you were home by time for bed, it was fine. You know, and it's such a different world. But people ask me that all the time. Why did you move back from Hawaii? Why would you move back from Hawaii? And I said, you have to ask that question. You don't get Utah, because Utah's just a different. This is my style. This is my state. And I take a lot of pride in this place.
Yeah, I think so, too. Like, it's really weird. But the funniest thing for me is everyone always told me how beautiful New Zealand is and how incredible it is. And I went down there for the Duke shoot, because there's a monument there for him.
That's right.
And I was looking
at the Christchurch bombing out of all timing, right before
happened, right when I was getting
there. Yeah, right. You know, I remember.
But I'm looking at all this beautiful scenery, and everyone's like, "What do you think?" I'm like, "It's Utah with an ocean around it. Yeah. That's all it really is to me. Like, I feel like I'm home."
That's right.
You know, I think all of our everything that got me where I'm at, you know, I feel like you too. This has to do with our home that we were just raised in.
That's right, and our circumstances and the people we're around. That's what we value that. So last, you know, before we cut you loose, Duke Kahanamoku, what can we expect? You've got this great project, you know, really showing a lot of love and respect and reverence toward an incredible man that kind of paved the way for a lot of what we do as minorities everywhere. You know, tell us about next steps there and kind of where you're going with that piece.
Yeah, well, I mean, the short version on Duke is I feel like he's the most important Polynesian, like, of the modern era.
Yeah.
You know, and it drives me insane that people out here don't, like, we have a huge Polynesian community that doesn't even know who he is.
Yeah.
But my uncle made the statue of Duke on the beach at Waikiki. And it was one of those projects he brought up to me to do. Like, you know, no one's telling the story of this guy. And the more I studied him, it leads to the exact same question every time. How many American athletes have statues and monuments in three different countries? You know, how many?
Yeah.
And there's none. It's Duke. He's the most famous American athlete around the world. And yet in his own country that he represented, he doesn't know. He's a man that he could, you know, not go in the history of Hawaii, but Hawaii's history is crazy. And, you know, he should have hated America.
Yeah.
You know, he was alive when the Queen was locked up.
That's
he
right.
He knew her, you know, and yet he wrapped that flag around his neck, represented the country, and embraced every single person that got near him.
That's right. Set a great example.
He's a level of kindness, and he found a way to make change that I wish people would pay attention to. And that's probably why the story might be timely. Because
I was going
to
say, that's a very timely story to tell at a right time.
It really is. And, you know, I think about it. You know, if an NFL player was standing, Ray Lewis used to do it, but if they put a flag around their neck.
Yeah.
And then talk about how they love the country and what needs to change.
Yeah.
Then you get the heroes.
Yeah, that's right.
You get the people behind you. That's how Duke broke every racial barrier in front of him without even trying.
Yeah.
Because he was just so kind and he embraced everyone around him. And then it's that spirit of Aloha at its truest form that he represented. And he was one of the greatest athletes ever to live. So the idea is just to tell this story. One for my uncle who made the statue, because we feel it's kind of a Kuleana thing now for the artist in the family to take care of it. But also, you know, my sister, you know, Mele, she wanted me to do something for my people, and this might be the only chance I get.
Yeah.
And what I didn't expect is for this to blow up, where now it's, you know, we have Kelly Slater, we have Jack Johnson, we have Chris Amore, who just won. She's on it.
Yeah.
I don't know who Kyle Lenny is. That dude is
Laird Hamilton, our brother.
Laird's on it. You know, we got everyone on board, and then finally, right now, I'll just say, you know, we got Jason Momoa. You know, he's going to be narrating the documentary.
Awesome.
I wanted to do a movie, but with surfing going into the Olympics, it just made sense to do a documentary now, movie later, because Duke's dream is for surfing to get in the Olympics.
Yeah.
And one thing a lot of people don't realize is when surfing debuts in the Olympics, it'll be the only non-white sport in the Olympics.
It's like, crazy.
It's an indigenous sport. It's our sport.
That's right.
As Polynesians.
Yeah.
And like when people look at Polynesians, like we talked about earlier today, like they see athletic, friendly people. And that's because the very first one the world really knew was Duke Onomoku.
Duke Onomoku. Mm-hmm. I love that. And I love, for those that don't know the term Kuleana, I love that Isaac brought that up because I think that's a great driving force. It's all about responsibility and a priority to make sure it happens. So I love that that was the driving force of saying, you know, it's my Kuleana to make sure and take care of that responsibility that I have to make sure I tell this story, which I think is awesome. So we'll be looking for that, Duke Onomoku. In the meantime, you know, I'm everything from dry bar comedy to go back and, you know, now that you see the man behind the legendary, you know, Imagine Dragons information and all the videos that come out, make sure you go take a look at it and have a new spin on taking a look at that and Last Descent, being able to go back and watch that. Go take a look at those things and now you can see why they were created and what was behind all of that versus it's a film, it's a music video or so on. There's a passion, there's a man, there's a whole vision, there's, you know, an artistry from a childhood age all the way through that's really been the driving force behind all that. And then we'll keep our eyes open for this story about the great Duke Onomoku.
Well, and I'm sorry. I'm like, I haven't gone to bed in 2 days. You could probably tell that's why I've gone through like,
I haven't, these. I think this is great. I love it. I love it.
I'm so sorry. It's just, you know, in the end, like my last thing is it is my motto on everything I do is that everything I do gets everything I have. And it's the only way I can let go of a project is when it's over, it's over. It's like losing. Losing is okay if you know you gave everything you have.
That's right.
I have something to study. And so that's why I haven't slept in days. I'm like, I'm just trying to get a couple more hours here.
Yeah. Well, keep doing your thing because say I learned this when I was a young leader and put into a leadership position. And I remember the first, when I became a director of HR and human resources with Starwood, the first job that I had in Colorado, I was still trying to figure leadership out. Because it was my first real role, having direct reports and so on. And being responsible for, you know, 150, 200 bodies. And then joining the fire department was a great pivotal moment in my life because I had great chief, battalion chief, lieutenants. Those were all great men that really helped me to understand how leadership works and so on. But I remember there was a moment in Kauai when we moved out there and it was just me and Jen and Marley at the time. And I guess Marley and Irie. And it was just us in a bubble. And I remember there was a lot of, you know, adversity I had to face. And, you know, even little things like, you know, we chose to have a stay-at-home family. My wife stayed at home our entire marriage. And
you're,
you know,
cut off at Kauai.
Yeah, I mean, we had nothing. It was just us and I was working. And whenever you'd face challenge, you always worried, like, are we going to get laid off? Or is the economy going to pick up? Is, you know, am I going to make somebody mad? And I remember being taught the lesson, leadership is a very lonely position. And there's a reason that there's a lot of people that don't choose to go there. It's not because they can't be leaders. It's because it's uncomfortable and it's very lonely.
Yeah.
But if you do it, you can break barriers. You can transcend, you know, entire, you know, important things in the world. You can be the change in the world. but it's going to come at a cost of being very lonely and being very uncomfortable. And so I love what you're doing with what your storytelling, you're bringing people up in the world, you're combining with people and connecting, your dedication to your craft, because you are the definition of leadership in that way, because you are going through and being uncomfortable and not sleeping and having to drink monster drinks and so on, because you're trying to make sure that your kuleana is straight and aligned by having that responsibility to tell the stories and bring our people up. And when I mean our people, I mean humanity. I don't mean just Polynesians. I mean humanity, and help them to understand greatness. And not only by teaching them about greatness, but living the greatness and telling the story about greatness. So I applaud everything that you do. I hold you in such a high regard. I love you as a brother. And I just appreciate you being able to break away with no sleep. It was funny. Isaac and I were, I think, texting last night, I don't know, 10 or 11 o'clock at night. He's like, I'm going to find some time to get together. And all of a sudden this morning, 8:30, I look at my phone. And he's like, I'll be there at 11. I was like, wow, that was quick. I love that. So thanks for taking the time to do it.
Well, thanks for bringing up Kuleana. I think that's probably the word your listener should look up.
Yeah, it is. Anything,
because that's the word, you know, I've only known for a little while. I think that word just makes me feel good.
It is. It's a responsibility, man. That's what we have to do. So, yeah. Brother, thanks. And your beautiful daughters, man, I've loved looking at these beautiful girls here. And
artists.
Shout out to Bianca for giving us some time with her hubby. Yeah. Had to get away. And yeah, sure. Love you, brother.
Thanks, man. I love you.
So for all those that are listening to the podcast, thanks for another wonderful episode. You know, I always enjoy being able to bring people on and tell their stories, and hopefully you're able to take some value out of what we talked about today, whether it be the Kuleana, telling the stories of our people. Just love spending this time. Glad to have Isaac, but also look forward to the next episode. Make sure you share this with your friends or people who would find value. And until then, my friends, aloha.